Welcome to the Mind Money Spectrum podcast, where your hosts, Aaron Ogti and Trishul Patel, go beyond traditional finance questions to help you explore how to use your money to achieve the freedom you want in life.
In this episode, Aaron and Trishul discuss their experiences as landlords of individual rental properties over the last decade. They go over the math to help you make an apples-to-apples comparison to investing in a liquid stock and bond portfolio, so you understand the opportunity costs involved. And even after breaking down the socioeconomic factors that affect real estate as an investment moving forward, they both agree that it is probably the psychological costs and benefits that will be the bigger factor in your decision. And now, on to our conversation.
Hi. My name is Aaron Ogti. I'm a financial advisor in the Bay Area, and I'm here with Trishul Patel, a wealth manager on the East Coast.
Hi, Aaron. Great to be here today, and thanks, everybody, for listening.
Great to be here as well. I'm looking forward to our conversation. Today, we're going to be talking about investing in real estate, and specifically investing in individual properties as rental properties. It's come up a couple times that Trishul has alluded with related to the FIRE movement, that he has alternative sources of income to help support his lifestyle. And my wife and I also own a rental property in San Diego. And so we want to share kind of some of the math behind investing in real estate, some of the risks and rewards that come with it, some of the benefits, some of the trade-offs, and also some of our personal stories, how we have dealt with issues that will come up as landlords, and kind of in the end, do we feel that it's worth it? Does that sound like a good summary of our coming conversation, Trishul?
Yeah, that sounds great. Thanks, Aaron.
Great, great. So my personal story is that my wife and I bought a house in San Diego in 2007. And a while later, we moved to the Bay Area in 2008. We chose to move to the Bay Area for jobs. My wife is in an engineer. She was an engineer, a software engineer. Now she's an engineering manager. And her family is here. So we wanted to raise our kids near their grandparents, basically. So this is a life decision to move to the Bay Area. And 2008 was not the time to try to sell the house that you bought in 2007. So we kind of got stuck with this property, and we have a lot of the observations. So we ended up owning a house in San Diego, but renting in the Bay Area for a long time. And it's just kind of, that's the way life works out. But now I have a good 12 years of observations and as a real estate property owner. And the one big thing I talk to clients about is that owning individual properties, a little like owning individual stocks, is high risk, high reward. And a lot of that comes from the leverage that a mortgage provides. And we'll go into a little more detail of kind of how these things work out. But that tends to be like my overarching message. It's high risk, high reward. Trishul, for you, when you think about owning individual properties as an investment, what's kind of your big picture message? What's the first thing that comes to mind?
The first thing that comes to my mind is the notion that we brought up before of opportunity cost, where you can't spend the same dollar twice. So if you're pulling money out of your portfolio to invest in real estate, that means it's not going someplace else. Typically, that money, if it's meant for a long-term investment, would be, for most people, invested in the stock market. So something to take into account is if you're taking money and putting it into a property, well, that money is then no longer growing in the market. So I think that's something that people have to keep in mind. Again, just because that rental property went up in value doesn't mean that you did better than you would have otherwise. So that's something that first comes to my mind when I think about this notion.
Okay, so then that's a really, really good distinction, is that my wife and I, we bought the house as our residence. And so we had been saving up and we got the down payment and kind of was setting cash, but we were going from renting to buying a house as our residence. And so that decision at the time was not a truly like pure investment decision. Keeping it was an investment decision. And moving forward, I think that's a really good distinction of owning a home that you live in versus renting an apartment versus taking money from some other investment and choosing real estate as the other investment. And that's a really good distinction, is that I don't know that we would have bought this house in 2007 just as an investment property, but because we already owned it, it changed our kind of mental calculation. But what you're talking about, the idea is that if we have this money already invested and now we're trying to compare it to how it was invested versus how it can be invested, that is really important to focus on. And so you mentioned last time that you want to try and kind of run some of the math. When you did that comparison and kind of the opportunity cost, what were some of your observations?
Well, there's a few examples about this out there, and I can just do a little bit of high level explanation of what I'm talking about. So let's say you bought a property for $500,000, maybe 10 years ago. Well, what that means is you may have put 20% down, 100,000 down, and over that time, that 100,000 would have probably grown to something like 250,000 today with like a 10% return over 10 years, something like that.
Like just the S&P 500 kind of thing?
Yeah, just investing in the market if you had not taken that money out and put it into a property.
Okay.
So then the question is, okay, so how much do you need to make on that property to equal that extra 150,000 that you would have gained in the market? Well, that means that property has to appreciate by a good amount. Now, there's a lot of moving parts here that you need to consider. And a few things you have to take into account is that you're going to be receiving some cash flow on the property for renting it out. You also have to include a lot of the expenses, though, including the mortgage and interest and things like that. But of course, there's the taxes to worry about as well. And also, it's going to take some time to manage this property. So all of this goes into the category of accounting for a property that you'll need to think about when you compare it against that simple investment in the market where you could have probably just set it and forget it. And okay, there are a couple articles about this, but basically you want to weigh these concerns if you're trying to make a decision on an investment standpoint.
Okay. So one thing I want to kind of, for the listeners, we're going to force them to do math in their head while they're listening to a podcast. And I don't want to keep it too difficult, so we're not causing any traffic accidents or anything. But I mentioned the idea of leverage, and you used that example as well. So we have $100,000, and we're trying to decide if we put that in a stock market or buy a property. With stock market with a compounded annualized return of 10%, that 100 is now about 250. With investing in properties and real estate, and we have leverage that the mortgage provides, we take that $100,000 as a down payment and we're buying a $500,000 asset. Means that we're borrowing $400,000 to get the equity up. So we're going to focus on the equity. Now we have $100,000 in equity in that property. If the property goes up 10%, the value goes from 500 to 550, your equity has gone up from 100 to 150. So you actually got a 50% rate of return on your investment. Now the high risk part means that works the other way as well. As the property goes down 10% from 500 to 450, your equity has gone down from 100 to 50. So you had a 50% loss. So when we put a 20% down payment, that's 1/5 of the value of the property, we're getting 5-to-1 leverage. We're amplifying a return up or down 5 times. And so from just an equity perspective, for that $100,000 to grow to 250, we need our $500,000 property to grow to $650,000. So now our equity is $250,000. In over 10 years, I just did the math, you only need a 2.6% annualized rate of return on the property to match the equity. So if you got greater than that, then the leverage the mortgage provides would give you a greater rate of return just on the equity comparison.
So, right. Basically, if the property return like 30%, 500 to 650, you would have achieved that $150,000 gain.
Correct. Yes. And that's the probably the single biggest part that I make sure the clients are aware of when doing the math is that the mortgage providing leverage amplifies return up and down and is one of the big parts of why this is a high risk, high reward strategy. Other parts of being high risk, high reward is that an individual property can burn down. It's you can have that one property can burn down while the one block over is still just fine. So there's a lot of risks related to owning that individual property. You also have things like tenant risk and vacancy risks. So if tenants can do damage, if there's no one there for a few months, then you still have to pay the mortgage payment even though you have rental income. So that adds to the risks that you're taking on, management, taxes. So all of these are factors, and we might want to explain them in detail a little bit, but they're just the leverage that mortgage provides does help amplify your returns. And that's what I think about when I compare the stock market return to a real estate return. That makes sense to you?
Yeah, it certainly does. That is the appeal. And at a high level, it does sound great. But I think it's one of those scenarios where the devil is in the details. So that's probably where we'll want to dive into a little bit to see where the high level doesn't really translate always to the lower level without ways that may trip people up.
What are some examples that you're thinking about?
A big high level example is the notion that a home itself, it has the ability to account for depreciation. And it's a great tax benefit. Basically, you get to say a certain percentage of the property gets depreciated, let's say over 30 years or so, and you get a tax break from that. But what I push back upon is there's a reason for that. The reason a property depreciates is because it is a depreciating asset. The actual house itself will have issues that require fixing and mending and upkeep. And that's why over the lifetime of a property, you could spend the amount of the property to keep it up to date and keep it going. Now, the land may appreciate, you know, land doesn't really die or corrode or disappear, but the actual house that's built upon the land, that could require a substantial amount of capital over time to keep it at tip-top shape. So that I think that's the first thing to think about.
Okay, so the kind of costs of maintenance. It's not just PITI. It's not just the principal and interest of the mortgage, property taxes and insurance. It's PITI plus maintenance and other hidden expenses that eat away at your rental income.
Right. So people typically depreciate a house, that $500,000 house over 30 years. And what that means is you might be spending $16,000-$17,000 a year to keep that property up to speed. Basically to make sure everything's okay. If it needs a new roof, or if it needs the kitchen updated, or if it needs new floors and so on. So all of that can add up over time.
I agree with that. And that's definitely a part of it. And when I am doing plans for clients, I actually build in roughly 1% of the value of the property is going to kind of ongoing maintenance. So in our example of $500,000 property, they're going to spend on the scale of $5,000 per year for maintenance that's not related to property taxes, insurance, or the mortgage. And I think that's a little conservative. Like spending $5,000 per year might be just a little bit too much, but spending $30,000 or $40,000 over a 10-year period, that's probably really realistic. It may not be 50 grand, but it easily could be. So it's not a bad assumption.
Yeah, I think the notion is most years you might be okay, but it's those big expenses that could happen, which or will likely happen over a 30-year period that also need to be accounted for.
Okay, yeah. And think about some of the kind of the math that I help clients understand when looking at investing in real estate. This is why I want to get your take. I'm really curious. Historically, so trying to give like a 100 years or longer worth of data, returns on real estate have a similar risk return profile as investing in stocks, investing in companies and other equities. And just that they're both kind of ownership aspects and the volatility is similar, but the total return historically for real estate is about the same as investing in stocks. But with stocks, you're getting, if it was 10% average over 100 years, you're getting something like 8 to 9% of that comes from price appreciation, and 1 to 2% of that comes from dividends, depending on the types of stocks that you're investing in. With real estate, if it was the same total return, say 10%, only on the scale of 6 to 7% is going to come from price appreciation. The rest of the total return comes from the rental income. So you're getting 3 to 4% of the value of the property in rental income. And one of the big differences that I try to kind of point out for clients who are aware of this, dividends are kind of really easily reinvested. You get a few dividends, it's really easy to buy another share of that same stock. So reinvesting dividends is really easy and convenient. It's one of the benefits of the stock market. When you're getting rental income, you can't exactly reinvest that into the same property. It kind of has to either become part of your lifestyle, which is most common, or you have to kind of save it up to buy another rental property. So it's sitting in cash for a long time. There was no mortgage, wasn't other expenses. And so that also part of the difference between investing in stocks and real estate is that even if the total numbers were the same, which may not be a safe assumption, a big portion of the return from real estate is from that rental income, not necessarily price appreciation. And I believe you have some thoughts on maybe that's not a safe assumption.
Well, there's a saying out there that real estate can either be a good investment or it can be affordable, but it can't be both. And what this means is that housing that's affordable is sensible for a good economy. It's sensible for a good society. People need to be able to afford a place to live. And for the good amount of the last generation or two, that's been the case. But what's been happening over the last 20, 30 years is housing prices have increased beyond inflation. Meaning, if prices rise, you know, let's say 2% a year on average, housing prices may be rising twice that. Now, what that means is the affordability of housing has gone down. And that small differential of 2% difference each year compounds to give you a 30% difference over 10 years. You know, so this can compound over time such that housing becomes less and less affordable. But it turns out that's a good investment because that means people are investing and making good money. But what it means is that the average individual has to spend more and more of their income to support their house. Now, if that trend continues, what that basically means is if somebody's spending maybe a generation ago, 15% of their income to find a place to live and to support themselves with a roof over their heads, they may have to spend 30% of their income now. Now, if that same trend continues for the next generation, can you imagine the average household spending 60% of their income just on putting a roof over their head? It doesn't quite make sense. And what that means from an investment standpoint is, if housing continues to become less affordable, it'll be a good investment. But I feel like something eventually has to break. Meaning eventually things have to come to a point where housing comes back to the point of being affordable. It can't continue to be less and less affordable.
So I agree with the statement that housing cannot continue to be a greater percentage of household income. It's kind of cost per housing cannot continue to go up as a percentage of household income indefinitely. You can't be spending 100% of your income on housing, and there's going to be some point well before that it's going to be a big impact. And I think the key distinction here, and this is going to be a big socioeconomic / kind of not necessarily just political, but it's like big demographic trends issue. And I think this might speak to why some people might be more confident investing in real estate and others wouldn't be. One of the key assumptions that you mentioned is that as housing has increased as a percentage of household income, that's because housing has increased faster than household income has been increasing. So if housing has been increasing at 5 to 10% per year over a generation, wages and household income for most people has not been increasing at that level.
Right.
And we have seen that wages and household income have been increasing closer to inflation. So I think that's one of the keys there, is that housing has been increasing faster than household income, period. So housing is increasing as a percentage of that household income. So now we have to try and make predictions / just guess. Moving forward, over the next generation, do we think that household incomes will go up faster than inflation? Which is the trend super long-term on the scale of century or two, that incomes do a pretty good job of rising faster than inflation? Or is it going to continue on the trend of household incomes are rising more or less in step with inflation, which it has been over the last generation or so? And this has actually been one of the big contributors to different income inequalities and other socioeconomic issues. So that's going to be, I don't even want to kind of, I'll force you to give a guess. And since I'm going to force you to give a guess, I'm going to make my guess as well. But that is the counter to your concern that if household incomes, you can't add a greater percentage to housing. That makes sense. I agree with that statement. But if household incomes are growing faster than inflation, then it actually can continue to support property growth and kind of that investment idea as being as real estate growing faster than inflation. That would also make sense. So over the next generation, do you think that wages and household income in general are more likely to keep pace with inflation as they have been over the last generation? Or do you think that they will be able to grow faster than inflation?
The concern with the past generation and the slow wage growth we've been seeing is a structural thing in relation to how our system of money is set up in the current United States, where a lot of the the growth in productivity ends up going to a small percentage of the population. So it doesn't really trickle down as theories would expect to the average household. And I think until those structural concerns are overcome, I feel like it might be more of the same. So I guess that's where my stance is.
Interesting. Okay. And when you say productivity, actually sounds like using that as the economic term, the idea of
you can GDP, but you know, that's not the best predictor out there.
I meant from the idea that with the same amount of human capital and other capital, whether it's technology, kind of to generate more productivity implies that either the human side is getting more efficient, which does happen over time, or the technology is getting better.
Right.
But it sounds like you're almost implying that workers and the human capital, possibly with the aid of technology, are getting more efficient, but they're not necessarily being rewarded for that. That is going to the ownership level.
Right. And there's a large theory that behind this that explains that if wages are not increasing yet, you know, valuations of stocks are increasing, then that money and enhancements in productivity is going somewhere, but it's not going to places that would actually help drive more economic growth. It's going into people that probably already have a lot.
Okay. I really like to use the word guess, because when you try to add anything other, getting to future predictions gets so wild and random. I do tend to be a little more optimistic, and I do think that capitalistic structures and even the acknowledgement of income inequality, I think that there's already some companies that the ownership and management are looking to do better by their employees. And you have enough states that have minimum wages significantly higher than the federal minimum wage. And so I think that is where society is going. And so I do think that wages and income in general will grow greater than inflation. I don't know how, I don't know how long it'll take, but I do tend to be a little more optimistic about that, because if we keep going on the current trend, something is going to happen to break it. That people aren't going to go to work for companies like Walmart, and Walmart goes out of business or something along those lines. That people just literally can't afford to work at Walmart. It costs them more time than they're getting paid. But it'll be something on that. That's an extreme example, extreme case. But that is my kind of optimistic projection, that employers will be forced by market forces to do better by their employees. And that if they're going to continue down this path, they will be disrupted at some level.
Well, I think that's the key word. I think there needs to be some sort of disruption beyond what we're seeing with the status quo, because it's already the case that Walmart employees can't afford the wage that they are. They rely on government subsidies to account for that wage gap, to make sure that they can afford to work there. So if that doesn't change, then yeah, I don't see the situation improving. But, you know, I am also an optimist. I should make that.
So hopefully that kind of helps understand kind of some of the big macroeconomic levels of why investing in real estate can help. I also wanted to ask you, what are your personal stories related to owning investment properties?
Right. Where the rubber hits the road, there are also concerns there. For example, if you are renting, it means you're basically now a property manager. You're managing a property and all the little nuances that come with it. So I've had this type of experience myself for the past, I'd say, about 13, 14 years. I too bought a property in 2007. And I probably moved as well after living there for a bit. You know, I went to business school and I had to rent it out. So being a young entrepreneur trying to find a tenant for the first time was an experience that I learned a lot from. Chiefly, I learned what not to do until I finally figured out what to do. But when you're renting a property, you're basically running a little business. And your business is to get a good tenant in there and to make sure things are paid on time and to make sure books are accounted for and taxes are paid and so on. So it does take a good amount of work as well. What I also learned is if you really want to invest in property and you really want to manage tenants, it really comes down to doing your best to find the best tenants you can. And that will make your life so much easier. That's what I learned. The first tenant I had, I basically had a few weeks to get somebody in there and run off to business school. And I didn't make the best choice, to be honest. The credit score wasn't up to par. And I thought I was doing right by choosing somebody that I thought had a good heart and the ability to put rent first as a top priority, but it didn't turn out well at all. I had to eventually ease the tenant out as quickly as I could. And there's only so much you can do, to be honest, as a landlord, especially when it comes to evictions. It's a really long and drawn out process. And during that time, your property may be falling apart under your eyes and there's not much you can do about it. So that's something to keep in mind. But also I did learn how to do it properly. And since then, I've actually had great tenants. I've been able to manage the property remotely, sometimes living in a different country, and I haven't had a vacancy in about 10 years. So it is possible to run a tight ship, but it does take time and effort. A few things that I learned is, of course, you have to screen vigorously as best as you can. You need to do all of those background checks and credit checks and call the previous landlord and make sure that everything seems sensible. And once you do find good people, things get a lot easier from that perspective. So I think that was a great lesson I learned along the way.
That's interesting. I like that the theme of management. It actually reminded me a lot of the kind of active versus passive comparison, because when we moved out of the area, we did hire a property manager and we asked around and they take 10% of the rent, and we have felt it's been worth it the entire time. We've been so happy having that person, even though I'm aware that there might be property managers that could do it on the scale of 5 or 6% of the rent, but having that property manager, even at that higher rate, has made our lives so much easier. Because everything you talked about, that managing the property takes time and energy, and we've been able to outsource that aspect. So we have not had any real long vacancies. And anytime we do, it ends up being kind of my own choosing. When a new tenant moves out, or a tenant moves out, we're looking for a new tenant, I'll tend to list it at the higher end of the range of the market in terms of rents. And then I'll wait a week before I bring rents down. But so anytime it's been vacant for longer than a week or two has been my own doing rather than the manager. But I've been very happy with them. And there's been a couple times actually that they have been life-saving. There was one particular instance where the tenant came home and the entire house was filled with 2 inches of water. There was a pipe on the back of the toilet broke. And so it wasn't anything of the fault of the tenant, and homeowners insurance was going to cover it and agreed to that. But there's even beyond just the cost, dealing with getting it renovated and getting back up to where it was took so much time. And I got lucky that the property manager was talking to the claims adjuster and dealing with all of the other vendors and repair work, and had to take up all the floors, put in new floors, like a foot of drywall around the entire house had to be taken out and new drywall put in, kind of thing. So, and having the manager there was life-saving for us. And but these are one of those real risks that come up with owning these individual properties. Another time, we were having issue with mold in a sunroom. We had the house was in San Diego, had a like glass enclosed room on the back patio, and there was when it was raining over the years, there's some issue with the room wasn't drying correctly, and so over years, ended up getting a mold issue. And tenants were complaining, there's actually a real health risk to the tenants. So we ended up having to try to have it repaired, and the repair work couldn't quite work. And so now we have to kind of list that as not an enclosed space. It's more just like a patio space. We got all the mold out and taken care of, but this is just one of those things of it wasn't an issue of something breaking, and therefore insurance didn't cover this. And now I'm having real conversations that, okay, it's going to cost $1,200 for this fix, $3,000 for this fix, or we can look at another strategy where we do the $1,200 plus probably reducing rent for a certain amount and like reimbursing tenants. And those conversations start to cost real dollars. And it costs money, but without the property manager, they're kind of communicating with the tenant and the different people examining the property and doing the work. I don't think that we could have done it. We would have been driven insane a long time ago. And that's just kind of the general theme of I hire a CPA. I don't try to do my own taxes. And I try to hire professionals to do a better job than I could do by myself. And it almost even gets to that kind of active versus passive strategy philosophy. And there's a lot of times paying for professional help is worth multiples of the money that it costs. And that's one of the things that comes up. Like what you said, you're looking for the right tenant. I've actually never had an issue with tenants, that they've all been good tenants because the property manager has been doing those screenings. And even if they move out, we're getting a new good tenant pretty quickly. So there are times I do wonder if it was worth it. And I have one kind of final story, but I want to ask you kind of, are you happy with your rental property? And kind of, do you feel that it was worth it?
That's a question that has been going through my mind. And it goes back to the first point I made at the start of this conversation, the whole notion of opportunity cost. And what I think about is it's a tricky scenario because, of course, over this period, we've gone through a scenario where, you know, from 2007 to now, the housing market crashed and then came back, but so did the stock market. And both have, over a beginning to end situation, have done quite okay. So from my perspective, it may have been a wash. I may not have necessarily come out ahead. And then I tie in the notion of the amount of time I put into the property. Even if I don't really do much, once I have that good tenant in place, it's been pretty carefree, to be honest, since then. There is still some issues that do come up now and then, or there's still some amount of accounting that has to be taken care of. And there is the notion that now you have a property that's 10, 15 years in, and it might need an upgrade here and there, like new floors or a new kitchen and things like that to think about. And when I think about that as compared to if I had just invested that passively in an index fund, I feel like it may have been a wash, and then therefore, why not go with the easier approach is what my mind kind of says. I recently found an example. I was just searching around a bit of somebody who did all the little math, and it does get tricky if you want to account for everything, where this individual bought a property in 2016 and sold it in 19. He bought it with about $50,000 down, and he made by the end of it, he had close to $100,000. So he almost doubled his money. Over those few years in the market, his $50,000 would have gone to $80,000. But then, you know, that $20,000 difference that he gained by investing in the property, he started doing all the math for all the work that he put into the property and the time and the effort and the commissions and the taxes and all of that. He would have only compensated himself about 1/5 of his current salary for the amount of time he put in. So things like that make me think twice about this notion. And then I always have that longer term view of my concern about housing prices continuing to become less and less affordable. And that kind of weighs in on my mind as well.
I think you hit on it. It's like when I talk to clients about potentially investing in real estate, one of the things I really point out is investing in a diversified stock and bond portfolio is so much easier. It's so much easier. Just lifetime hours. It's just so much easier than owning an individual property, even with the property manager. The time and worry and kind of all that anxiety and stress that just is not there the same way. And maybe it's because I'm a financial advisor and I don't worry about ups and downs of the stock market. That's possible. I can actually see that other people do worry about those ups and downs and don't worry about the real estate and dealing with tenants. That I can see just different personalities. So I make sure to ask every client, like, are you going to be happy being a landlord? Not even if the money works out, or the money's a wash, it doesn't matter either way. Are you going to be happy being a landlord? How is your lifestyle going to be better by being a landlord in that regard? And I still think it was worth it. And this actually gets in, again, to the kind of psychological happiness aspects. The reason I think that it's worth it, even if the money would have been the same, is it took 10 years, roughly, but we're now slightly cash flow positive, where we're getting a couple extra $100 per month than our total costs. And so that's just going into our checking account and supplementing our lifestyle. And that's only going to increase because we have a fixed mortgage. And as rents go up over time, which is pretty consistent, that amount going up each month and supplementing our lifestyle gradually increases. And I think the comparison is if we had invested in the stock market, while the asset level might be the same, we wouldn't be taking anything out. We wouldn't start to withdraw the dividends. And this is also pretty consistent that people, they might take big chunks of money out of a liquid portfolio if it's not in retirement accounts, but they kind of just let it grow if they're disciplined investors. And I think investing in real estate kind of helps our lifestyle a little bit before retirement, if that makes sense. Instead of saving up a big pile of money and then waiting to retirement to determine a distribution strategy or a withdrawal strategy and how we're going to use that to support our lifestyle, by investing in real estate, we feel a little more comfortable of spending that extra $100 or $200 per month that we're getting from excess rental income. And that's only going to go up over time. And this is one thing I do see pretty consistently for those who invest in real estate versus those who invest in the stock market, and it's not one or the other, but it does help people supplement their lifestyle while they're still working. And it's just a little bit. And usually the case is they pay off the mortgage when they retire. So now all the rental income goes to their lifestyle. But there's usually some gap of excess income that I don't think people would choose to spend if they invested in the stock market. They would keep reinvesting it. And even though technically in terms of the way the math works, they could start spending that, I don't think they would. And that's one area where I actually do kind of feel happy with that investment. I don't know that I'd do it again moving forward, but I can see at my current stage in life, the fact that I own a rental property, that's going to supplement my lifestyle a little bit moving forward. And I do like that. Took 10 years to feel that, and that's kind of the way any investment works. You got to wait a decade or two before it really pays off. But it's a little easier to feel comfortable taking this super small amount now that'll increase over time. And I don't need to wait until retirement before using this asset to supplement lifestyle.
That does sound interesting. It sounds like you have a PhD thesis that somebody might want to work on, the psychological benefit of owning real estate over a passive portfolio. I get what you're saying. It does make sense to me. In fact, I've noticed it myself. So I think you might have something going there, Aaron.
So maybe just like everything else we end up talking to about choosing to invest in real estate versus the stocks, kind of ignore the numbers. Don't worry about whether one's going to pay off versus the other. Don't worry about the economics. Just are you going to be happy being a landlord? And would you appreciate the slight benefits of that little excess income that take 10 years to pay off? So are you happy as a landlord?
It's not so bad, but I'm not sure if I'm entirely happy as a landlord, to be honest. I am happy psychologically by two things. One, again, this is psychological, but with real estate, you know, it has the word real in it, right? You can see it. Whereas stock, yeah, I know I own a piece of IBM, but it's probably buried in a brick somewhere in one of their headquarter offices. But real estate, it's a little more tangible. So I see that as well. For myself, I have these two properties that are cash flow positive, and they kind of fill a need for my long-term plans. I always wanted to have a place in New York or close to New York that I could easily commute to by train or get to by train. So that's the first one. And the second one is in Florida, that, you know, kind of near the beach. So I always thought that'd be nice to have as well. So I think just psychologically, long-term, I feel like they might be good places to have as I want to be less mobile down the road or settle down a bit. Of course, I could always rent, but these things are real. So maybe that provides a little more benefit of knowing that my plans are a little more solidified.
The last topic I wanted to bring up what I've seen for clients who do own rental real estate tends to come with estate planning. When clients own liquid portfolios of stocks and bonds, a good withdrawal strategy, so we've kind of talked about this before with 4% rule, but a good withdrawal strategy, if you're going to be flexible or be able to make adjustments, you're probably going to be spending down your principal a little bit over your lifetime. And there's a kind of, we won't spend it all down, but you're going to be going, if you start with $1 million, a lot of times you might end up with 600 grand. Like, there's no risk of running out of money, but you have less than you started with. For those I see with rental properties, they live on the rental income, but never access the equity of the home. And that property ends up being left to heirs. And I have seen, this is pretty consistent, that real estate tends to be passed on to family and heirs and beneficiaries more effectively than a stock and bond portfolio. And it's usually just a case of they don't choose to access the equity and they do choose to spend down the principal of the stock and bond portfolio, which again is just more psychological. That they could have spent more by owning that property, but they have chosen to they've inadvertently spent less from that asset by only taking the 3% rental income. And so I do see that states with rental property tend to pass on more of that to heirs. But I think the way the math works, if they could have made the same decision with a stock and bond portfolio, they just chose to spend more.
Right. And, you know, the stock and bond portfolio is more liquid, so it might be easier to you know, sell a few percent of that each year than your living room and then your basement and then
I think the, yeah, I technically would use something like a reverse mortgage or home equity line of credit. Like you're borrowing against that principal. But yeah, I like the visual of the cartoon of like, okay, who wants this bathroom and who wants this bathroom? And this bedroom's a little smaller than this one.
Right. But I'm keeping the backyard.
So I'm going to be left with my bedroom, my kitchen, my living room, and the backyard, but the garage I don't need anymore.
Well, we didn't even get into the whole Airbnb notion of the basement, but I'm sure these opportunities will also be available to individuals.
I think that would be a different conversation, because now you're getting into like just future economy. Like, do you need to supplement your income with an Uber or Lyft 1 or 2 hours a week to afford the house that you just bought? Because right. Wages aren't increasing.
We certainly aren't running out of things to talk about.
No, I have been enjoying our conversations, and I do feel like there's always something left on the table for next time. So thank you very much, Trishul. I really liked hearing about your experiences and your personal life a little bit more.
Well, thanks, Aaron. I enjoyed today's conversation as well. And thank you, everybody, for listening. We really enjoy your support. And of course, if you like what you heard and you want to subscribe, we are available on all the major podcast platforms. So go ahead and do so. Thanks, everybody. And thanks, Aaron.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.
We appreciate you joining us today for this episode of the Mind Money Spectrum podcast. Be sure to visit mindmoneyspectrum.com to access the entire library of episodes. Remember, it's not black and white, but the wide spectrum of gray area where you get to pursue the freedoms you want in life. Opinions voiced in this material are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. All performance referenced is historical and is no guarantee of future results. All indices are unmanaged and may not be invested in directly. Have a nice day.